So my name is Navya. I'm an R1. I'm about 7 months into residency now. I already told you this. So I'm doing the two small groups today. I guess we said we wanted to start on the hypertension one. Mm-hmm. Okay. So who wants to read the little scenario? Or anybody?
A 48-year-old African-Canadian male, James Desmond, comes to see you in your office because he's worried about his blood pressure. He measured it once on an automated machine at the pharmacy and obtained a reading of 155 over 95. He has no other complaints. He takes no medication. He is mildly obese, 90 kilograms, 1.72 meters, smokes half a pack a day for 20 years, drinks 2 to 3 beers per day, and does not exercise regularly. On this initial visit, you take his blood pressure twice and obtain readings of 160 over 100 and 165 over 100.
Okay, so what are things that sort of stand out in that little blurb?
His age, 48.
Okay.
He's African-Canadian.
Okay.
He's a male.
Yep.
Smoking.
Yep.
His BMI.
Absolutely.
Alcohol and does not exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And no asymptomatic otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And no medications.
Yeah, at least doesn't mention any that we can see on this list. Okay, so question one, what is the improper technique for measuring blood pressure? So who wants to give it a try? Who wants to come up here, and I'm the patient, and tell me what I should do if you're in a clinic and need to take my blood pressure? Who wants to? It's okay, it's just a camera. Cameron, pick you.
Wait.
No, the cameraman. No. What's your name, by the way?
Stuart.
Okay. What was your name again?
Hallie.
Okay, so Hallie, why don't you come up? So I'm a patient, and you're going to take my blood pressure. And you have, I'm on. This is like the bed,
yeah.
And then there's a chair, and. Yeah, and you have to take my blood pressure. So what are you going to tell me to do?
I usually tell the patients I'll be taking their blood pressure, so mm-hmm. just explain it to them. And then I usually have them sitting comfortably,
mm-hmm.
Make sure they've been sitting for a few minutes. I don't know exactly what the amount of time is.
It's about 5 to 10 minutes.
5 to 10 minutes.
You just let them sit. By the time you actually talk to them and know they know you, I find that actually when I see a patient for the first time, their blood pressure, they're a little bit more nervous because they don't know me very well. But once you've actually had a rapport with a patient, they're more calm. And when you come and you just talk to them, how are things going? How's the weather? How are your kids? Et cetera, et cetera. They're just much more calm. And at that point, I tend to, as I'm talking to them, then I'll give them a couple of minutes to just sit quietly and then go around and get the blood pressure cuff and have them sitting.
So you have to make sure the blood pressure cuff is the right size.
Yeah.
I think it's something like 80% of 20%. I read it
40%.
Somewhere. 40%?
40%,
okay.
Yeah.
And then you can... I always have the arm at the level of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I usually hold the arm.
Mm-hmm.
Munching it. And then I usually first... Again, I don't know if this is right. I usually first inflate and see about where I lose the pulse.
Okay.
Just to have kind of an idea where the systolic is.
Okay.
And then I listen over the brachial
mm-hmm. with your
stethoscope. Yeah.
And with your ear. Okay, before we get to that, what are you missing here? What you should be sort of doing with me? I'm sitting down. Mm-hmm. My arms and my feet are together on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So not the leg over, not either. Both legs on the ground and your hands like this. What else should you ask me to do?
Like, no talking, like...
Yeah, that too. The other thing is removing clothing. So you can't put a cuff over... Even though sometimes if it's a really thin shirt,
yeah.
Sometimes that can actually make things a little bit higher than necessary,
okay.
Or you might not hear properly.
Okay.
So you would ask them to, like, remove their clothing. So or and even rolling up sometimes doesn't...
Yeah.
Might change stuff, so you want to ask them to remove whatever they have on. And then where do you want to place your cuff? Yeah, so you put it about there, and it should be about 2.5 centimeters
okay.
above the antecubital fossa. And then you listen with your stethoscope, and what are you, also you're palpating, you said the radio pulse.
Yeah.
And what are you listening for? What's it called?
The
Krotkov sounds? Yeah, I can't even pronounce it properly. Krotkov sounds? I don't know.
Krotkov?
Okay, Krotkov sounds. Perfect. So then you put the cuff on, mm-hmm. and then you're listening to my pulse.
Right over there.
Okay. And then, okay, so then where, up until where do you pump till?
Usually, is it 20 above where you lose the pulse?
Yeah, so you start pumping, you're listening, and then you lose the brachial mm-hmm. pulse, and then you always go 40 above when you stop, when you don't hear the pulse, okay? And then from there, you
bring it down slowly to where you start hearing
yeah.
the sounds.
Yeah.
And then that's the systolic.
Yep.
And then you go keep going to where you lose the sound.
Right.
To your diastolic.
Which is your diastolic. You bring it down gradually as mm-hmm. you're bringing it down. So about, they say, in notes, it was photocopied from Bates, that it's about 2 to 3 millimeters HG per second or something like that. But, I mean, honestly, you're not really going to sit there and measure that. But, yeah, that's perfect. I don't think there was anything else that we really missed.
No,
any?
Is it like usually two readings?
Yes. Sorry about that. Yeah, you do 2 readings. And the other thing is you want to do a reading in the left arm of the left and the right as well,
right.
In both. Okay.
And like patients who've had like axillary dissection and things like that, like their contraindications too. Like
yes, yeah. In that case, their contraindications. It's important that they tell you that this has happened or that they've done this, because if you're getting a new patient, it's really sort of hard to know. Again, looking for scars. If you see pertinent scars in their arm somewhere, or then you might say, "Well, what was that?" And then they'll say, "Oh, by the way, I had this happen to me, and like I lymph node dissection in that case," and then that would be a contraindication for taking blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's anything else I was missing. Do you guys have questions? So it says here, so width of the cuff should be 40% of the upper arm circumference. The arm should be free of clothing. The patient should be sitting so the back and legs are supported. Should rest quietly for 3 to 5 minutes. So 2.5 centimeters above antecubital fossa. And everything else I basically told you. It says take the blood pressure in both arms at least once in your assessment. So they say at least once. But usually on the initial assessment when you're seeing somebody and it's elevated, you want to take it twice, right? So, any questions with that? So B says, what impact does improper technique have on blood pressure measurement?
Well, I guess if you get a higher reading, then it might not be a true high reading. Like, let's say you left the arm down, it'll raise the blood pressure.
Yeah.
Falsely.
Yeah. That down, or if you don't support the arm of the patient and you let the patient support their own arm, that can elevate the blood pressure.
So
what else?
If the cuff is too tight, then it can falsely raise the blood pressure reading.
Absolutely.
If it's too loose, then it can lower.
Yeah. Anything else?
I'm guessing when you're hearing the numbers, and that's not a very good reading.
True. But there's always going to be a little bit of error when it comes to that. But
there's also, in between the Krotkov sounds, there's a point where there's a, the Krotkov sounds diminish, and you could falsely interpret that as the diastole.
Yeah, and what's that called?
Is it the...
I actually didn't know what this is called either until I read this. Oscillatory gap. And it's caused when you don't listen for the radial pulse when you're doing the blood pressure itself. Like if people, you just start pumping randomly and then you get that gap in that in the middle. The other thing that it says here, and what's important in clinical practice, is when you have your patient to figure out what cuff you're going to use. So if the patient is a little bit more obese, then it's important to use the large cuff or the regular cuff or the smaller cuff, depending if the patient is extremely skinny, because that can also change your readings. Position much... So too short or too narrow cuff, brachial artery position much below the heart level, falsely high. Ask the patient to support the arm himself. That will raise his BP. And then the radial pulse, not listening to the radial pulse at that point. So How is hypertension defined?
Regular hypertension is systolic over 140 or diastolic over 90. Mm-hmm. You can have isolated hypertension where systolic over 140 and diastolic pressures are normal.
Yep.
Okay. Or you can have elevated diastolic pressures. The regular run in the middle is 140 over 90.
Okay.
Yeah, it has to be over a period of time. So let's just say the initial visit comes in and this patient, well, he had, and this guy had.
I don't even remember what this guy had. 155 over 95. So that's going to make you want to repeat your blood pressure. So we said that in the initial visit, if it's greater than 140 over 90, then you keep that in mind, like, oh, this patient's blood pressure is high. And then in the second visit, you would measure it again, and then again in the third visit. But let's just say at the second visit, what would be the cutoff of an extremely high blood pressure that you would just start treating right away?
In general, like 160 over 100 is like the stage 2.
Yeah.
So that you don't really need to wait to you can treat immediately.
Right. That would be at visit 3. So at your third visit, if somebody comes in and they have a blood pressure of 160 over 100, then you would consider, okay, let me just treat this patient right away. It seems like he's very high blood pressure. Now, what would be at visit 2, what would make you, like, signals go off and say, okay, well, maybe I should start treating this patient at visit 2.
They're having sort of, actual, symptoms that are, damage to certain organs?
Yeah, in terms of the definition of blood pressure.
There's, urgency. Like, if there's an urgency hypertension or, systolic is greater than 210 or diastolic is greater than 920.
Yeah, there's that, absolutely.
Or, an accelerated phase where you have a significant increase.
Right. Okay.
Significant rise.
Right.
And there's, you can see vascular damage on endoscopic examination. But there's no papilledema. It's caught in the low spots.
Right. That's one part of the hypertension that we have. But I'm getting that there's actually a value at the second visit.
So 180 over 110.
Yeah, exactly. So 180 over 110 is what I'm getting at. Just looking at the numbers. And this is what the CHEP, basically, the Canadian Hypertension Education Program. These are the numbers that they've sort of set aside for you to follow. They say here, teaching point, and I think this is what I'm supposed to tell you, is that the diagnosis of hypertension should be expedited. So basically, if you have this issue in your clinic, then it should be something that should be on the top of your list to reevaluate the next time. Not really leave it till the end of the clinic or the end of this, be something that you should definitely go after. And then they have other definitions, and I didn't really know this off the top of my head when I'm only actually looking at this now, but ambulatory blood pressure monitoring and self and home BP management in terms of the numbers for that. I don't know if you guys know them. Off the top of your head. I can tell you.
Well, we have
the charts.
Oh, okay, so then you have the numbers there then, eh?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, off the top of my head, I wouldn't know this. I would give a guess around the numbers that they're telling me. So they're saying mean awake blood pressure is 135 systolic over 85 diastolic, and mean 24-hour blood pressure is 130 over 80. How they make that differentiation between the 5 plus or minus, I don't really know. So, and self-home BP measurement, the average home BP is 135 systolic or greater than 85 diastolic.
And I think, the other indications for that, if they have possible theoclosis, coma, or, refractory hypertension, is that when, other than those values, is that also when you use ambulatory monitoring, or?
You would use ambulatory monitoring if you're definitely if you want to make a diagnosis of blood of hypertension, at that point you would. How often people use 24-hour blood pressure monitoring for regular blood pressure, or essential hypertension, not very often. If you feel like the patient has a lot of white coat syndrome, for example, they come in, you're not really sure what their blood pressure is, and like, could this be artificially elevated because they're nervous, they're looking at me, or could this be, could this actually be a rise in their blood pressure? So at that point, you might want to think, okay, maybe 24-hour monitoring is good, I can come up with a diagnosis, and then everything will be good. The other reasons for 24-hour monitoring for Theo, not really. Those are more where you have the emergency blood pressure, like the or hypertension, or the isolated emergent hypertension that would bring you usually to the emergency room. And at that point, sometimes not. Sometimes you see it in clinic and it'll be isolated. And at that point, you would sort of, the numbers in itself and the other symptoms that the patient would be coming in would make you want to think of secondary reasons for hypertension. And you probably would start going a different route, like you'd start doing a lot of labs and imaging and trying to figure out where that goes. But sometimes it's hard. It's really difficult to tell if this is secondary hypertension or not. But we'll talk about that later. So we'll get to that at one point. Any other questions that you guys have? Okay. And how about for diabetes? That's a really, really common multiple choice question.
It's over 80.
Yeah, and that's usually by the second visit. If they have it greater than that, then and they're diabetic on top of it, that you should say, okay, I should start treating this patient. And kidney disease?
Same thing,
130/80. And proteinuria, 1 gram per day, greater than 1 gram per day.
125/75.
And that, I believe, is it. What's really important about home BP management? What's one really big thing you want to do, like clinically wise, when you ask a patient to come in and you know that they're measuring the blood pressure at home?
Well, to make sure they're not doing it, like they leave an hour gap before, you know, after exercise or smoking or BP meds.
Yeah, you definitely want to see they're doing it properly, like how do they use it, and how do they wear it. What other things do you want to do?
You want to have them bring in their machine?
Yeah, that's like super important. You need to make sure it's calibrated properly and that it's working well, and that it's a machine that's recommended, I believe, by the Heart and Stroke Foundation. That's also important. Usually there's more of a reliability if it's from the Heart and Stroke Foundation. That's extremely important. Ask them to bring it in. Also asking them to bring in their meds and all of that stuff, but that's for generally for any patient, but for hypertension, that's important. All right, question 3. When should you consider that the patient might have secondary hypertension? So we sort of talked about that a little bit. So what are the two types of hypertension you can have?
Primary.
Yeah, and primary is?
Central.
Yeah, and... Yeah, multifactorial being the big thing, and accounts for about how
90.
Yeah, 90, they say 95 here, so not 90, 95. A lot, basically. And it's you said multifactorial. What are the two big things that contribute towards it?
Age.
Yeah, I would put it under like more environmental factors and genetic predisposition. So in terms of genetic predisposition, that's basically genes, your family history, and environmental factors. Why don't we go around the table and tell me one thing for environmental factors?
Okay.
Diet, absolutely.
Cholesterol levels.
So risk factors for cardiovascular disease, yeah.
Level of exercise.
Pardon?
Exercise.
Yeah, like low, not as much exercise, like sedentary.
Sedentary.
Yeah.
Alcohol.
Mm-hmm. You said what, cigarettes?
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, you say,
wait,
we said obesity,
or? No, we haven't. Obesity, absolutely. Huge impact. And last but not least,
No, I forget all of it. Was I still just like that? Medications,
it usually falls under secondary hypertension because the medications would cause it. Think about lifestyle. Think about our lives, guys.
Stress.
We're stressed out. That definitely can lead to central hypertension. And in terms of diet, what's really particular about diet?
We
could
contain
saturated fat.
Salt. High sodium levels in food. So that's essential, basically. And secondary, when would you look at somebody and say, maybe this patient has secondary hypertension?
If it comes on, like, pretty early.
Yeah.
Or in the 30s, or, like, late, like, about 55.
Yes.
It's refractory to, like, medications.
Yeah.
Using combined.
Quick onset.
Pardon?
Like a very quick onset, a rapid change?
Yeah, a rapid change. So going from like lower to higher, definitely.
Like any clinical symptoms like that would go together, like symptoms that would feel
Yeah. I mean, it's not listed here somewhere, but definitely, I would think so. I mean, why not? If they're coming with all of these other symptoms and it's like screaming Cushing's, then yeah, you're going to look for other secondary causes, right?
Electrolyte abnormalities, like hypokalemia, hypertonia.
It's really hard nowadays. I have a patient who's 25, it's extremely high BP, always comes in, it's 150 over 110, and I'm like, we did a whole workup, I haven't found anything. He's a bit obese, no real family history, so it's really hard to tell. Like, is it because our generation's changing and the younger generations are getting more and more obese and more sedentary and more that we're seeing essential hypertension earlier on in age? Could it also be, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's in the genes. It's sometimes it's really hard to tell nowadays. So you've got patients coming in. Or drug abuse, exactly. I mean, he's just not willing to tell me that he's using drugs, you know? It's really difficult to say sometimes. So, question four. Oh, any other questions about that? Are you guys okay? Good. Question four. What is the target organ damage associated with hypertension? Again, we'll go around the room. Just shout out whatever you want. Multiple. There's a ton.
Retinopathy.
Yeah. Okay. What about cardiovascular? What do you get?
You can get coronary.
Okay. Like acute things that can happen to you with your heart.
Well, I think I've done that.
Okay. Anything else heart related? Anybody?
Congestive heart failure.
Yeah, congestive heart failure.
You can get arrhythmias.
Arrhythmias. Angina. That's one thing that we can lead to eventually an MI. And this is left ventricular hypertrophy, which makes sense. So we talked about the eye, we talked about the heart. Okay, Jeff?
The kidneys as well, so you get like protein in the urine.
Mm-hmm, protein in the urine. So a picture of chronic renal failure that starts. Absolutely. Forget your name again.
Jeremy.
Like
stroke, encephalopathy, so brain related.
Yeah, so stroke, TIA. What other thing? Think about the elderly. Yeah, multi-infarct dementia, for sure. Anything else? So we talked about brain, heart, anything else?
Peripheral
vascular. Yeah.
So like an abdominal, like ischemia or whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Anything else you guys can think of? I think we pretty much covered up everything. I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. I'm sure there's a lot more like little things that we're missing. Question five. What other important information do you need to know in this patient's medical history?
Family history.
Yep.
Diabetes, previous history of cardiovascular disease.
Stress level.
Diet. Thyroid levels.
Do you see any herbal supplements?
Thyroid levels? The history?
Well, no. I mean, if he's known or he knows.
Yeah, so past medical history for sure. Yeah. So we talked about diet. We talked about past medical history, family history. What do you want to know particularly?
Yeah.
heart attacks.
Especially what age? Diabetes, lipids, whether renal, like kidney disease. What other thing? Big thing. Sleep apnea, like
sleep patterns, whether they're getting appropriate sleep or waking up.
One big thing also that should be
Age of onset. If they have these.
Age of onset. I was looking at endocrine disorders. So if they if in the family, if thyroid disease, then that'll like maybe ring a bell that maybe I should screen for thyroid, you know? Or if they have any other endocrine disorders, like there's Cushing's in the family or lupus or something like that. Being antibody disorder. We talked about psychosocial factors like stress and everything. You want to ask about sexual function as well. That could be it could be affected by their psychosocial factors as well, but also by hypertension too. What would be some symptoms of like organ damage that you want to ask them?
Palpitations.
Yeah.
Problems with vision.
Premature,
yeah.
Yeah.
So for TIAs, so for like short periods of time, I couldn't speak or.
Headaches.
Yeah. Dyspnea. Yeah, I said that. But yeah. And then.
Vision
changes. I think we talked about that too. Palpitation. And if you're looking at secondary causes, what are some that we mentioned for FIO? What are some of the symptoms that they could be coming in with? So those symptoms. We're not going to go too much over that. And then for Cushing's, it would be like muscle weakness or thinning of the skin. Or if somebody has lupus, then they'll come in with like their stigmata of that. Yeah. Question 6. What do you look for on physical exam? So let's start at general appearance.
Specifically, weight, like in general? Yeah, you were getting that. You said weight, right? Yeah, like weight. How do they look? Are they heavy?
Are they? Yeah, absolutely. Body weight, extremely important. And what else? Vitals. Anything else? General appearance. So, like, oriented and alert, you know, like, if they're coming in multi-infarct dementia, at an early onset of it, they might not be all there. Skin, what would you look for?
Might be suggestive of, even the peripheral vascular disease.
Okay. Anything else?
Dryness.
Okay. Yeah, dryness in terms of like kidney, absolutely. Edema, if you're thinking maybe this person has CHF or new onset CHF caused by hypertension, sure.
If you're thinking lupus, go for any rashes.
Yeah, there you go, rashes or atrophy if it's Cushing's, if you're thinking of that. Eyes, we talked about looking at the fundoscope exam. And what would I do with the neck? So thyroid being the big thing. You also want to listen for any bruise, the carotids. And heart?
S4,
absolutely. So S1, S2, S3, S4, and murmur. And abdomen, what do you want to look for there?
Renal bruise
being really important for sure. And
AAA.
AAA, yeah. So like feeling for if they have an abdominal AAA or a bruit over the abdominal aorta, absolutely is important. A femoral pulse, looking for the femoral pulses. In the extremities, they put edema under that, so it makes sense though. So in the extremities, you look for edema. You look at the hair and the nails and the peripheral pulses, especially for the new peripheral vascular disease. And then obviously like a gross neurological assessment. You don't necessarily need to sit there and do all the cranial nerves or anything like that, but just grossly what you think. Question 7, how would you manage this patient at this time? So how many readings do you need in the first visit?
Two in the first visit. At least that's what CHEP says. At least two readings should be taken in the initial visit, and the patient should be scheduled for further visits. So that makes sense. What would you start him at the second visit? Would you start him on medication right away? Would you start him on medication right away at the first visit? What would you do at the first visit?
He doesn't have any symptoms, so I wouldn't start him on any medication. We would maybe just counsel on healthy lifestyle, like maybe stopping smoking, increasing exercise, eating healthy, cutting down on alcohol, just try and see if that could have a beneficial impact on his cognition.
Yeah, absolutely. So lifestyle is what you should really like focus on at the first visit. You can also ask him, they say here you can suggest him to purchase a home BP cuff, depending on how enthused he is in getting this under control. Sometimes you'll have patients who are like super enthusiastic, doctor, I need to get this under control, and they're very anxious about it, so they'll want to go and buy a BP cuff and do all of that. So then I'm like, well. So that, then it's, it might be harder to get them on board. But definitely the first visit, you want to go through all of the lifestyles. So smoking cessation, decreasing alcohol consumption, decreasing body weight, stress management if they're in the high-stress job, regular exercises, and basically consumption of a good diet. So you can refer them to the Canada Health Guide and say, like, look high in fruits and vegetables, decrease sodium, and low fat, like, dairy, like, fat foods, basically. So they say teaching point. Lifestyle modifications are the cornerstone of both antihypertensive and anti-atherosclerotic therapy. You should also sort of, like, he might come into your office and say, well, why are you telling me about all these lifestyle stuff? You know, just give me some medication. And it's realistic for them to say that because it's like, well, you're asking me to lose weight, stop smoking, all in one session. I mean, it's obviously, it's difficult. I mean, patients can't right away start doing all those things. It'll take them time. So you have to explain to them that a blood pressure, making a diagnosis of blood pressure or hypertension takes a couple of visits. You can't do it right away. And that it's been shown that with lifestyle medications, lifestyle modifications, and eventually hypertensive medications, if he requires it, can actually give a synergistic treatment for the patient. And sometimes, if they're really good with lifestyle, they can get their blood pressure down and you don't even need to have them on. Can't have them on medication at all. So again, teaching point. Combination of therapies, both drug and lifestyle, are generally necessary to achieve target blood pressures. So the second visit, he comes back, and his reading is 155 over 95. Are there any laboratory tests that you'd like to order at this visit?
Lipid profile?
You want to get a lipid profile.
Electrolytes.
Yeah,
renal function tests.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Fasting glucose.
Fasting. What did you say?
Fasting glucose.
Fasting glucose. Yes. Urine analysis and EKG. Yeah. Perfect. So, urine analysis definitely. What I usually do is I do a CBC and then I do obviously a potassium and a sodium if you're thinking that you might start these patients on eventual antihypertensives, a creatinine as well. And, I mean, usually when they come in, they're over the age of 40, so I might as well, if I'm going to prick them for blood, I might as well do the whole annual checkup and just check their glucose, lipids. And then I would do a TSH also, just because that could give, if he has hypothyroidism, that could also give him hypertension or hyperthyroidism, for that matter. I do analysis, too, if I'm suspecting that there might be something there, too. Something I would do. EKG, I don't know if I necessarily would do that all the time. If there's something in their history or a symptom that they're having that makes me cue in and say, maybe I should do an EKG on this guy, then I would. But otherwise, I don't think I would necessarily do it right away. Visit 3. Patient returns 1 month later and his blood pressure is 165 over 100. So, assuming that all his laboratory investigations and physical exam are normal, would you initiate pharmacologic therapy at this visit?
Yes.
Yes, you would.
Most likely start on 2 meds because of his severe hypertension.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
No. You always start with monotherapy, and then you go from there. But we'll talk about therapy later at one point.
So why would you want to start him on medications?
Yeah, the third visit, it's over 160 over 100.
Mm-hmm. So third visit, if it's 160 over 100, then or equal to, you would then start medic. And then they don't necessarily need to have any other symptoms at that point, if that's their value.
So they say here, antihypertensive therapy should be prescribed for an average diastolic blood pressure of 100 or more, or average systolic blood pressure of 160 or more in patients without hypertensive target organ damage or other cardiovascular disorders, so are at risk factors. So you don't need to necessarily wait for them to have these other risk factors or organ damage to start them on medication if they're 160 over 100. Now, what if they do have some cardiovascular risk factors? Do you think this guy has cardiovascular risk factors? Yeah? Okay, good. And so he does. He already has that. At what point, like what level would you start treating him because he has cardiovascular risk factors? Does it change the number, or what do you guys think?
It changes the target and it changes the medications that you use. I'm not sure about what the specific numbers are.
Okay. If the diastolic is greater than 90 or more, then and they have cardiovascular risk factors or target organ damage, then at that point you would start them on medication even at the third visit.
Even
at
the
third visit.
Okay.
Yeah, because they say it's 160. Over 100, right? And so they'll say, oh, well, you know, this person's not at 90, so I'm not going to start them on medication. But if he's got all those cardiovascular risk factors, it's enough for you to say, okay, you know what, I'm going to start treatment anyways. And that's despite whatever the systolic is, eh? So systolic can be like 140, and it doesn't matter. If it's 90, then at that point you would start. And then they say here, antihypertensive therapy should be strongly considered if systolic, so now we talked about the diastolic, so if systolic is 140 over 159, plus cardiovascular risk factors, plus target organ damage. So those are the limits, basically. Do you guys understand that? Confusion? Want me to repeat something? Get it? Cool. Okay. Yeah.
Sorry, so even if they're above 140 for like three separate visits, nothing is working, like let's say they're 150, there's no other cardiovascular risk,
mm-hmm.
This is their third visit, you wouldn't...
Necessarily? Not necessarily. I would definitely work... not that I wouldn't say anything, I would say lifestyle. I would definitely work on lifestyle, like quitting smoking, doing this, doing that.
It could be up to 160, like as long as they're less than 160 after three visits and no other cardiovascular disease, they might not receive medication.
In reality, we probably would find some cardiovascular risk factor in them, if they're male or if they're at that point. Would I necessarily start? It depends on how they're responding. If they're doing very well with their lifestyle, I probably wouldn't, and I would, if I see a trend and that they're falling, and I would continue and maybe see them for another couple of more visits, like two or three more visits, and see if their blood pressure starts dropping with lifestyle modifications, I wouldn't necessarily start medications at that point. If there's somebody who's really anxious and says, doc, I really want to start medications, would I necessarily be pushed towards starting more a medication? Depends on the case. Really depends on the case. But technically, if a patient is 160 three consecutive times with no other... I mean, if they're 160, for sure you would start them, right? Because it's 160 equal to. But if it's less than that, if it's 150 over 90, no other risk factors, perfectly fine, I might look for other secondary reasons for hypertension, because that could be a reason, other medications that they're on or whatnot. But if there's stuff that they can work on in terms of their lifestyle, I would probably do that first. Does that sort of answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, like at this point, the third visit is like 3 months in. So if you, after their first visit, if you started to recommend lifestyle changes, then you've already had around 3 months of...
Lifestyle's interesting, a long time.
Yeah.
Takes some time for lifestyle. By 3 months, I mean, if they're doing fine and I don't start noticing any target organ damage in them, then I would continue on what they're doing and I would just let them out. But if they're over that limit of 160 at that point, then I would.
Does that make sense? I don't know if I made myself clear. So, like, if they're consecutively 100 and greater, if they're like 140 over 90, and they're greater than 140 over 90 for 3 or 4 consecutive visits, I would start them a medication. But off the bat, at the first visit, if they're 160, I wouldn't. Am I confusing people here? Am I confusing you? I feel like I'm confusing you.
No, that's fine. If they're 140...
They're greater than 140 over 90 for many cyclophysiotherapies, like for 4 visits at that point, I probably at that point would initiate... this is his 3rd visit. Hold on, I'm confusing myself. 1 second. Yeah, so I was right. So, okay, so when I mentioned there, so after the 3 visits, you would look for that value, and if that value isn't there, so the 160 over 100 at that point, then I would lean more towards lifestyle modifications than I would on just starting off medications right away. I'd probably give it a little bit more time. Like, reality speaking, it depends on the patient. It depends on how compliant I know they're going to be. If I think that they're going to really be gung-ho about lifestyle medications and go to the gym and start losing weight and stop smoking and really take an effort to do more, then maybe I'll give them a little bit more time without medications and see how they do. If I know for a fact they're not going to and they're not doing very well with their lifestyle medications, they're very sedentary, very not really enthused, don't really care so much about the blood pressure, I might maybe start them on a blood pressure medication. Okay, so it takes it as it goes. There's all these definite definitions that they put together, and they're recommendations, but you have to sort of take them as a case-by-case basis.
Okay, so clinically, this is what, I know these are the guidelines, but most physicians also, sort of maintain that rule. Like, I know some would start earlier, but in general, your experience is that the physicians sort of follow those guidelines?
I think so.
Okay.
Physicians usually would follow the guidelines. I think experience has a lot to say. So a physician who's extremely experienced and is more comfortable letting the patient wait without medications would probably be more likely to do so. Maybe a younger physician who doesn't have as much experience would want to really follow the guidelines more strictly because they don't really have anything to base it on. But once you have a lot of experience, there's a lot to say for that. So does that sort of answer? I'm sorry if I confused you guys for a while. So they say here, the patient's systolic BP is 165 and his diastolic is 100. Given that he has cardiovascular risk factors and possible target organ damage, he should be put on antihypertensive medications together with advice regarding lifestyle modifications. So what do you think what medication would you start him on?
Because he's black, I believe ACE inhibitors are not the best choice.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the other options are sort of beta blockers and diuretics,
mm-hmm.
Or beta blockers and calcium channel blockers.
Mm-hmm.
But I think beta blocker and diuretic would be the first.
Mm-hmm. So, is it beta blocker and?
Diuretic.
And diuretic? Yeah, I would, what you said for sure, the patient is African American, so I wouldn't start him on an ACE. You said the classes where we talked about diuretics, we talked about ACE inhibitors, ACE and ARB, us together in a group. We talked about the calcium channel or long-acting calcium channel blockers and beta blockers. Beta blockers, I would be more hesitant to start beta blockers in an elderly patient as initial therapy, just for whatever reason that they might have other interactions with their medication. It might be contraindicated in whatever their past medical history has. You don't really want to put them on a beta blocker and slow them down any more than they need to be. And ACE, for example, not recommended in blacks. I usually start somebody in a thiazide. I mean, the clinical experience, I guess, and learning from my staff and stuff, that it seems that everybody really likes to start people on thiazides as a first line, thiazide versus an ACE. So that's what I've usually seen. So would you start this patient? What would be the target blood pressure that you want for this patient?
Less than 140 over 90.
Yeah. So you want less than 140 over 90.
Yeah, unless you have diabetes
or any other comorbid, like renal disease or proteinuria. And would you start this patient on 1 or 2 meds?
1 med.
1 med. I would give a trial of 1 med and see how they do and they respond to it. If they have no response to it whatsoever, maybe I should change the group at that point, of a class of medications, or you could increase the dose, 1 of the 2, to see if that works. I'd probably increase the dose first, see how that does. If that doesn't work, then maybe change the class. And then if changing the class helps a little bit, but not as much as I need to, in the subsequent visit, I would maybe start combining 2 meds.
Would you follow up in a month, in 2 months?
I would first follow up in maybe the first 2 weeks or so. Because it's a new medication you're introducing into their system. You want to see side effects or for whatever reason they're having any issues. After about 2 weeks, I would maybe bring them back. If they're tolerating it well and they're responding to it a little bit, then I would bring them back in a month and see how they're doing, and subsequently like that. Until I really feel like I'm at a good baseline with their blood pressure and they're quite stable and they're doing well, then maybe I can reduce it down to maybe every 3 months or every 4 months. And some of my blood pressure patients, I see them every 6 months. So it really depends on how they do and how compliant they are as well with their medications. So they say here, teaching point, reducing hypertension-related complications in the general population of patients with hypertension is more dependent on the extent of blood pressure lowering achieved than on the choice of any specified first-line drug. Was there anything else I need to say here? Yeah. And then sometimes you'll need to go to triple and quadruple therapy, but it really depends on the patient and how other comorbid factors and how their diabetes is being treated. Question 10, how does hypertensive patient underlying medical conditions impact upon the choice of an antihypertensive medication? Do we have until 2:30? Okay, good. So, diabetes, what will make you want to, what will be your first line for diabetes? Thanks, yep. And for angina?
Beta blockers?
Yeah, beta blockers. I mean, there's others that you could have on the list. They say consider using ACE as well. Heart failure, what would you say for that?
ACE.
Yeah, an ACE, good. So it gives the remodeling effect of an ACE inhibitor.
Diuretics,
and what specific type of diuretic would you want maybe add on?
Spironolactone.
Yeah, spironolactone. Because of the potassium that it can add to the system. If you've had a history of an MI in the past?
Beta or ACE.
Past CVA or TIA?
Diuretic
ACE. These are really good. Renal disease? ACE, yeah. And they say here peripheral arterial disease or dyslipidemia doesn't affect the initial treatment recommendation. So you basically can treat them with whatever you're comfortable with at that point. Any questions about that? What is the target value of blood pressure control in this patient? So we talked about that already. We say less than 140 over 90. Diabetes, we talked about it, less than 130 over 80. And renal disease, less than 125 over 75. Question 12. What are some reasons for poor response to pharmacologic therapy? Number one that you will be faced with. Yes. It's extremely frustrating. other conditions the patient might have.
Liver.
Somebody's your liver?
Yeah. Well, I guess if there's medications that affect metabolism.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Any other things about the patient itself?
If the cause is secondary,
for sure. Obviously all the lifestyle stuff, if they don't really lose weight and are still obese, cigarette smoking, alcohol, sleep apnea. You had mentioned that before. That's also a really big thing that can cause hypertension. You might want to suggest a CPAP machine or something that would help them with that. Chronic pain. That's also a big thing. If they're really in a lot of pain for other reasons, that can make a big difference. What about drug interactions? We mentioned some drugs. Which drugs do you think would sort of interact?
Well, I guess, like, pentotal liver carbamazepine, like, kidney, liver, sort of...
Specific ones that are more common that would affect blood pressure, you have to be careful, are NSAIDs. So NSAIDs really, and you'll be prescribing that left, right, and center if you go into family medicine. I mean, so many people come in with musculoskeletal problems, and you prescribe them naproxen, and you just throw it at them, and you say, hey, take naproxen, but then you have to think twice, like, is this patient have high blood pressure, are they on medications? Because then they might, if they take the naproxen for a period of a month or something like that, then their blood pressure can shoot up because it can decrease the ability of the drug to actually work. So there's that interaction.
The NSAIDs are contraindicated with ACE inhibitors as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oral contraceptives as well. So that's also why, off the top of my head, I actually can't tell you. It's something I need to look up. I'm not sure. I imagine maybe. Actually, I really don't know. I really have. I can't think of anything that would. Why? So that's something for all of us to look up. Corticosteroids. So if you're on corticosteroids and you take blood pressure medications and sympathetic mimetics and decongestants as well, can affect your blood pressure medication. And obviously, if the dose is too low. Or if it's not, or if you do an inappropriate combination. So let's just say I'm adding a patient on two medications. What would be an inappropriate combination?
ACE and beta blocker, mm-hmm. or calcium channel and diuretic.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm thinking more of like an obvious mistake that would really not work well.
Calcium and beta blocker. I don't know, actually.
Calcium beta blocker is okay. I'm thinking more along the lines of if you add something from the same group. So if you put an ACE and an ARB, like an ACE and an ARB is really not going to work in your favor. So volume overload, they say here, excessive salt intake. So if the patient has taking in a lot of sodium, secondary hypertension, which we mentioned, and definitely huge is white coat effect. Like I didn't realize how much of white coat effect exists. Until I came to family medicine, and I'm like, wow, patience is unbelievable. As you start developing a relationship with them, their blood pressure will creep down with every visit. It's really interesting to see. So it's there. That's for sure. It's a reality. Any questions? I think we're done the first one. Hypertension. It's a bit long, but any questions? Okay. What time is it? It's 2:01. Do you guys want a break? Like a 2-minute break? No? You're okay? Okay. Can I have a break? Thanks. I need water.
Oh my god, my voice.
Yeah. No, you're not supposed to do it, or if they have an IV. amazing because they don't remind you of like, people don't remind you of like, it's something that like, I remember. Like, I'm always like,
so that's your advertise or
look at but it's,
yeah.
Like,
I love the
mic. It's like, it doesn't copy my keys.
Oh.
It would?
Is it okay?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you're going to record this one, too?
Yeah, because it would be really big.
So you
want
to
record
this?
Because
the
original is the fact that... No, it can be caused. So
you
have to pour it out. But they have poor absorption. Poor absorption of the material, so I guess that's a good
Alright, do you want to start the second one? 204. Okay, so who wants to read the clinical scenario for the second one?
I can read it.
A 40-year-old woman with vitiligo and no other health problems presents to her office complaining of generalized fatigue, lethargy, and weight gain for the past 6 weeks. Upon further questioning, you discover that she's also been constipated recently, experiences muscle stiffness, and has noticed a general intolerance for cold. But more to what you want to say.
I'll start with you. What do you want to know?
I want to know about life stressors and anxiety, feelings of sadness.
Mm-hmm. So you want to know about, generalized sort of terms of fatigue, so emotional status and all of that. I actually don't have that on my answer key, but that would definitely be something that you would ask. Let's just say for the purposes of this case, no. She's doing okay. Her mood's great. I have no issues. Yeah, life is good. So...
I'd want to know about menorrhagia.
So in terms of menorrhagia, periods are usually good. Her last period was about 4 weeks ago, and she had tubal ligation 2 years ago as well, just to give you a little bit more information on that. But they're regular, they're not very heavy, and not too many like painful PMS-type symptoms.
History of radiation exposure?
Does she have history? I imagine no. I'm a cancer key. Good question. No.
Thinning hair, dry skin, slow speech, sort of symptoms of hypothyroidism.
Okay. What does it say here? No. She has intolerance to cold and muscle stiffness. Mm-hmm. Other than that, no. She doesn't have those symptoms.
A bit along those lines, I was kind of thinking any history of like thyroid dysfunction for which she might have received any kind of radiation therapy.
No, because it says up here no other health problems, right? So she's had no past medical history. So you can go again.
What about like family history, just kind of get a baseline?
Yeah, that's important. So her mother had Graves' disease. Hmm. So that's okay. What other question do you want to ask?
Medication,
she's
taking?
Good. No medication.
I wanted to ask about constitutional symptoms, sleep habits, fever.
Okay. Okay. So what would you do in a review of systems? Like, what type of review systems would you do? What are the things that are important? Like, if I'm going to say I'm going to do cranial, or CNS review of systems, I'm going to do GI review systems. What type of review systems would you guys pick here?
Endocrinology.
Yeah. Okay.
I would also look at cardiovascular.
Okay, what would you look under cardiovascular?
Like pallor, like symptoms of anemia.
That's a different type of review systems. Anemia is separate, and then you've got cardiovascular. Okay. And cardiac risk factors. Yeah? So what would you be looking at anemia? What type of symptoms?
Well, perfusion, so color of the skin, first off. Mm-hmm. If there's noticeable pallor, the strength of the pulses,
Is this as well?
Yeah, or syncope.
Yes, palpitations or concerned murmurs.
Yeah, chest pain, bleeding history. That's what I asked about analgesia. That's good. Melina, bright red blood per rectum. Yeah, and also anemia of reviewing systems is negative. She's no pallor, but she's noticed a little bit of puffiness around her eyes. And what would you ask in a cardiac review systems? Yeah, shortness of breath.
Chest pain.
Yeah.
Sweating.
Yeah.
Edema.
Pardon?
Edema.
Edema. Yeah. Peripheral edema. And basically all the risk factors for coronary artery disease. And then you would also ask like claudication, orthopnea, PND. And basically everything is negative in this woman.
Why did you ask those?
Because it's fatigue, right? So you're trying to sort of figure out, is this fatigue more exertional or not? So that's like the big question that you're trying to figure out here. The fatigue can be associated with underlying heart disease. Like what if she's slowly going into heart failure? Or what if she had, you know, a silent MI and from there after that beginning to have these symptoms? Or she has some kind of anatomical defect to their heart that's giving her these problems, or not necessarily cardiomyopathy, but other things that could give you cardiac risk factors. So she says that if fatigue is general, it's not related to exertion, and is not associated with shortness of breath. And so what other things? We talked about endo review of systems, we talked about GU review of systems. What?
System.
Yeah, so like GI.
No, nervous system.
Oh, you said nervous system.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, okay, I gave away an answer. So, no, not nervous system, but more GI. You would look at, what would you look up in GI review system?
Bulimia, maybe because you were getting bulimia.
Yeah.
Constipation.
Maybe mucus in the stool.
Yeah. Yeah, steatorrhea, absolutely. Steatorrhea.
Any nausea, any vomiting.
Eating appetites, weight changes.
Yes, weight changes is very important. Weight gain or weight loss, changing bowel habits, gastric reflux, peptic ulcer disease, jaundice, pruritus, things that she would ask. So she's noticed some indigestion, and she's noticed some, obviously, constipation that we mentioned from above. But other than that, that was it. So that's question one. What is your...
Sorry, we wouldn't do nervous system, like for,
myasthenia
gravis or, other... I mean, I know she says it's not on exertion, but...
Mm. You could do a quick review of systems. I think these are the ones that they're keying in terms of their differential. If all of that comes back negative and even, like, other things, and you're not thinking, you can't really figure out what it is, then maybe you want to go into the more unique things and ask a review of systems and that, but... I think these are the main review systems that she would want to do. What is your differential diagnosis of a person whose chief complaint is fatigue?
The top are like psychogenic or sleep, thyroid.
Okay. I would keep psychogenic and like stress and just regular fatigue as my last thing. It wouldn't be the first thing I think of, because it's more of diagnosis of exclusion that you put those under.
So neoplastic?
Okay, so neoplastic, malignancy, for sure. Wouldn't be the first thing I would think of, but absolutely on my list.
Anemia?
Anemia, absolutely, for sure.
Alcohol?
I think you'll put that lower on my list, but in conjunction with alcohol, liver disease, that would be on my list.
Diabetes or hypothyroidism?
Yeah, diabetes would for sure be like concern coming in with new onset fatigue. Diabetes or hyperglycemia would be like probably my first couple that I would think of. What else?
Depression?
Definitely. Absolutely, psychiatric disease, major depression. Seeing that she said her mood was okay, I'd probably put that lower on my list, but it would be something that I would think of.
I know she's not on any medication, but if she was, I would think of maybe side effects from medication.
Sure, yeah.
What about from some substance
Can be, absolutely, especially if you're thinking the elderly, then for sure, like, medications can induce that, or if you're talking about other habits, for sure that can do that too, like alcohol, drug use can give you fatigue. But what would be, like, we talked about cardiac risk factors, right? So I think I would put that maybe probably like third or fourth, maybe second or third on my list. In terms of thinking heart failure, or is this a valvular problem, or is there something going on here, even though she said it's not exertional. But what would be the number one thing that you would start thinking of?
CHF? What do you mean in terms of cardiovascular?
No, differential, sorry, differential diagnosis. What would be the number one thing that you would have in your mind that's saying, maybe I should do this, rule this out first? Yeah. Yeah. So hypothyroidism would probably be the first on my list. And then everything else would come after that. I think we mentioned a bunch. And the last one they say here is chronic fatigue syndrome. So again, that's a diagnosis of exclusion. So what would you look for on exam?
Just the alert
oriented.
Mm-hmm. Look for any
glitters. Yep.
Dry skin, coarse hair.
Yep.
Happiness.
Yeah.
Color.
Yeah. What are things we should look at?
Multilateral. Yeah. Eyebrows.
What's that called? Queen Anne sign. I don't know why I remember that.
Bradycardia.
We talked about it earlier. What was the earlier thing we talked about? The last small group was about?
Hypertension.
Yeah. So what would you want to look for? Blood pressure. And you look for? Orthostatic changes. So that's important. Did somebody say cardiac exam? I don't know if any of cardiac exam?
Murmurs.
And abdominal exam, looking for like stigmata of liver disease. Yeah, but we said everything. So on the exam, the patient's heart rate is 50 and their vital signs are otherwise stable. You observe that the patient has dry skin and thin coarse hair. The skin around her eyes are puffy. She has an obvious goiter that feels firm and lobulated on palpation. Deep tendon reflexes are delayed. So, how would you guys examine the thyroid? So, I'll get two people to come up here and show me how they examine the thyroid. So, we'll get Jeb. And we'll get... Did you say Michelle was your name? No. What was your name again?
Carol.
Sorry. Carol. Show me both approaches. I have to sort of say what you're doing. So, great. So why don't you show me the anterior... Actually, why don't you do the anterior approach on him, and he'll do the posterior approach on you.
So first I get my glass of water.
Okay.
The first thing you do is you observe to see if you see any obvious nodules. You can put in a light tangentially,
yeah,
and that'll often show you if there's an enlargement of any sort.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go ahead and palpate. So it's under the thyroid cartilage. Mm-hmm. So right here.
Okay.
So you can help me with the isthmus.
Great.
Help me on both sides. Feel for any nodules or any enlargements.
Okay.
Swallow.
When you're asking them to swallow, what are you doing?
So you feel the isthmus.
Rise. Okay. Okay. So what you're basically doing, so you ask him to sort of turn his chin a little bit to the right, okay? And then once he's turned it to the right, then what you're going to do is you're going to push with your left hand the larynx more to the towards the left, okay? And then when he swallows, you, with your right hand, palpate the side that you're pushing over.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, guys?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when he swallows, you basically, that's what you do. Okay, do you want to do it again? And show me the other side. How would you do the other side?
So I'll ask him to turn to the left. Did you swallow?
So then with the left hand, you push the larynx more towards the right, and then you palpate the right side with your right hand. Make sense? It's okay?
Mm-hmm.
Good. Okay, do you want to do the other side, the posture approach?
I'm not sure if we do this sitting, actually. I think standing is okay as well for the posterior.
Posture or standing is okay as well.
Okay, because that's usually how I do it. But it's kind of the same thing I thought that she was saying, right? As in, like you just you go around the, where the thyroid is, and you're kind of pushing on one side as well, and you feel for nodules in the,
yeah,
in the side.
Yeah.
And then also you put, it's kind of like you're using both hands at the same time. And then again with the swallowing, so you also give her a glass of water, and you're mm-hmm. feeling for the isthmus kind of going up and down.
Yeah.
And I mean, if it's a normal thyroid, then you really shouldn't feel anything.
Yeah.
And it's really when you feel like asymmetry or nodules that are kind of suspicious.
Yeah. Yeah, so exactly. So I find actually the anterior approach, you have more of the pushing and then feeling when they swallow, and you can time it with the swallowing. The posterior approach, I feel, is a bit less rigorous in terms of doing that exactly how it is. It's more you swallow and then you're in a way blind looking, but you're feeling for what you feel there. And it's the basic thing is that you just support your hands against the sternocleidomastoid muscle, and then you sort of at that point, yeah, just sort of palpate and you feel through if you're feeling anything. I mean, it depends on what you like. Some people like the anterior approach, some people like the posterior approach. Sometimes it depends on patients. If you find patients are very nervous, then you might not want to do the anterior approach because then you're going to be like right in front of their face. Mm-hmm. And they might enjoy the posterior. Some people who are very anxious and don't really like somebody creeping up behind them like the anterior approach. So it really depends on what you can see they're comfortable with and what you're comfortable with too. Like if you really feel like the blind approach is too much for you and you want the anterior approach, you could do that too. All right. Thank you. So, what tests should be ordered and why?
CBC.
Yeah.
Yeah. TFH.
Yeah. And what else would you do with CBC?
Infection.
Yeah, infection. What did you say? You said,
I think TFH.
TSH, absolutely. And what else would you want? TSH and a...
T3.
Yeah, usually you get to T4, but you can get T3 too.
Mm-hmm.
Liver profile.
I do TRH as well. TRH.
Yeah, generally speaking, on a regular workup, I don't think I would order one. If maybe I'm thinking this is something fancy, something else is going on, I would do a TRH.
Iron studies.
Yeah. If I would actually do iron studies. Some people say. It depends on who you're working with, really. Some say just do a CBC. If it comes back as anemia, then you'll do the iron workup. I'm thinking more like if I have to go and ask them to get pricked twice, we might as well think of looking at the folates, whatever, then I would look up, do the ferritin workup and the iron studies at that point.
If you're suspecting like heart failure or even cardiac, would you do
an
EKG then?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, we're doing EKG. And also, in hypothyroidism, EKG, which they say here, it's just flattening of T waves. To be honest, how often you would actually see that? Probably not. But, I mean, if you're thinking anything cardiac, for sure, get an EKG, if you think it would help you. The lipid profile was interesting because you actually sometimes do see hypercholesterolemia and hypothyroidism as well. We talked about... Somebody said thyroid, we talked about that. Anything else thyroid-wise? You can. It probably wouldn't be the first thing I would measure, just because it's uncommon in North America for to have an iodine deficiency. Anything else thyroid-wise? If you're thinking, this patient has vitiligo, and vitiligo is... You could do an ANA workup for that, but I'm thinking more like if it's an autoimmune, then maybe this thyroid could also be...
Thyroid
antibodies. Yeah, there we go. Thyroid antibodies. That's what I was trying to get at. So maybe this is an autoimmune process. And, I mean, she already has one autoimmune disease that could be linked with it, so maybe it's worth getting a thyroglobulin antibody just to see if that's affecting anything. So we talked about... What else we talked about? So LFTs, you would do that as well to rule out hepatitis. And we talked about an SMA. I would do an SMA 7 to see what their creatinine is like, to see if maybe there's a renal disease and their electrolytes as well. What else would you do? She's a woman, and she's 40, and she still has her period. Yeah,
beta HCG. Always. You'll never go wrong.
Any woman that comes in and she's not menopausal, beta HCG. I would do a fasting glucose in her. What else would you do on her? One other thing. This is a little bit tricky. Serum lithium. If she has a history of taking, if she's on lithium medication, mm-hmm. lithium can give you hypothyroidism. So that could be a reason for you to do that as well. What is the differential diagnosis of hypothyroidism?
Autoimmune, meaning
what type?
She
knows.
Did you like primary nutrition?
I don't know. You can just shout out whatever.
It was iatrogenic, so like neck radiation or previous thyroidectomy.
Yep.
Even iodine therapy.
Yep.
Iodine deficiency, not so prevalent here, but in different countries.
For sure, Pardon?
Cancer?
Yeah, cancer.
Medications like amiodarone or lithium.
Lithium, absolutely, yeah.
The pituitary dysfunction?
Yeah.
Low TSH?
Yeah. Like, can you like pan hypo? For sure. Prostitution, yeah. What other things?
Infiltrative diseases.
Yeah. Those are more secondary causes that we're talking about, but I mean.
Subacute,
exactly, yeah. Recovery from subacute thyroiditis. It's very common. And then secondary causes, we talked about panhypopituitarism, we talked about sarcoidosis, I don't know if we talked about that, but sarcoidosis, tuberculosis, hemochromatosis, Sheehan syndrome. You want to rule out pregnancy, which is a big thing also, that can give you transient hypothyroidism. And a major depressive episode apparently can, which I didn't know. Apparently can. How do you treat hypothyroidism? So, is it always treated?
It's like subclinical.
Okay, so this woman, her TSH was elevated, and her free T4 is subnormal. So would you treat her?
That's overt, so it would be treated.
Okay, because it's overt. Because your symptoms. Yeah, perfect. So I'll just read you what it says here. It says, subclinical hypothyroidism is not universally treated. The choice to treat is therefore dependent on the severity of symptoms and the degree of hypothyroidism noted on physical exam and laboratory findings. The woman presented here is clearly symptomatic and should be treated, presuming the labs correspond with her clinical picture. Her serum TSH is elevated, her free T4 is subnormal, lithium ingestion, panhypopituitarism, and iodine deficiency are ruled out. It said, what are your treatment options? What would you treat her with? Yeah. So levothyroxine. And if she's iodine deficient, you would treat her with iodine. How come you don't see iodine deficiency here? Where?
Iodine.
Oh, and where do we have it? What is it in that we all drink?
Water?
Yeah. So there's iodine in water. There's a little bit of iodine in water, and that's why we don't get
we're not
lacking. I'm pretty sure about that. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that there's a little bit of iodine in water.
That's why you should filter your water.
Yes.
Be like that one crazy person. Like, if I had a
patient. And corticosteroid replacement. If the patient has like panhypopituitarism, that would be a reason for treatment. But usually it'll be Synthroid. And how does levothyroxine or Synthroid work?
Well, it's T4, so it's basically peripherally converted into the T3, which is the active
Perfect. Apparently they say that a select group of patients have diminished ability to convert T4 to T3, so exogenous T3, or levothyroxine, may be given with levothyroxine. So, I never have encountered that yet, and so I don't know how often that happens. Apparently, they say the half-life is 8 hours. So everybody's going to forget that once they leave the room, which is fine. And the dosing of Synthroid.
Well, you can start to, for young patients, you can start them on, like, the standard dose of, what is it? It's 1.6 micrograms per kilo. But in elderly populations, you sort of have to titrate up.
Yeah. Usually it's about 50 to 100 micrograms once a day that we usually give. You can titrate up if you need to for whatever reason. In elderly, like you think you mentioned that in elderly, you want to start off a bit slow. So you usually start off at 25 micrograms and you work yourself up. If you're coming into the eMERGE and you've got like really bad hypothyroidism and it's like mixed edema coma, like terrible, then you would start them on like a mega, like a 300 to 400 micrograms in addition to hydrocortisone therapy.
Would you give T3 immediately instead of waiting for T4 to be converted?
Good question. I don't know. I've never seen an exedema coma, and I don't really know too much about it. Would I? Would it make it go faster in any way? I would imagine so, because it doesn't have to do that extra, the extra part of converting. So, yeah. It's a good thing maybe look it up. What else does it say here? Oh, in terms of follow-up. So what would you do for follow-up of this patient? If you're starting them on Synthroid and you have to monitor their TSH, when would you see them next?
6 weeks. 4 to 6 weeks.
Yeah.
3 to 6 a while, depending on
their
symptoms.
Yeah, depending on, so about 4 to 6. I mean, there's no hard, fast rule. It depends on how the patient is. It also depends on if the patient's extremely anxious and wants to see you again quicker, you can see them quicker. Send them home with a blood rec so that they can get the blood requisition at least a week before they see you, so you get the blood tests done. And that's the beginning. And you want to just make sure at that point that the T4 is not being over-replaced, so you're not giving too much. And what would be the problem of giving too much? What things can happen? Sort of replacing too much. Hypothyroidism, what else? There's two other big things.
Well, you can start to put them into like a subclinical hypothyroidism where the TSH gets normalized, like you have normal T4 values but the TSH is still low, and that's
unlikely.
Also unlikely
that they would have that reaction. I'm thinking more in terms of if you put them into hyperthyroidism, what other things can hyperthyroidism give you? Arrhythmias, is that what you said? Arrhythmias, so AFib. And a BAA thing, especially women. Osteoporosis. Mm-hmm. So hyperthyroidism is a big cause of bone loss. So that's definitely something you want to look at. Okay. Usually Synthroid is given for life. Sometimes you wean them off, sometimes they get better and you take them off and so on, especially if they're recovering subacute thyroiditis, they might come back to normal at one point. They say here that patients who have radiation exposure or family history of thyroid cancer or Menn's syndrome or those with Hashimoto thyroiditis should be followed more closely than you would on an average patient because of the risk of malignancy, so they can get cancer from this. So every time you see them, definitely when you do a full physical, you want to make sure you're focusing on the thyroid and checking to see if there's any new nodules that have showed up or any other new symptoms. And if that's the case, then you need to do more imaging. So you could do an ultrasound, thyroid scan, or going up to a biopsy or a FNAC would be something you would do. All right. Any questions? Anybody? I think we're done. Thanks, guys.